I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, election years have a funny way of making politicians act courageously.
I don't think there's anything more urgent and more frustrating than addressing the issue of encampments in the state of California.
Also, King County taking major steps to try to address the eviction backlog. The judge in charge of those decisions joins us.
I think the biggest takeaway is that we're trying to increase capacity to give people access to our courts.
And a seven-year-old wanted for robbery in Seattle, just the latest example of a youth crime crisis that's out of control. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Stunning, isn't it? In an election year, how many politicians suddenly, they find courage, they find clarity, they find common sense, they're acting sane. It's just a remarkable thing. And that's what's happening today down in California. Now, I'll give credit where credit is due. I saw this and I thought, good for Gavin Newsom. Those are four words you probably will never hear me utter again. Good for Gavin Newsom. This is the headline from the New York Times. Newsom orders California officials to remove homeless encampments. The Times calls it the nation's most sweeping response to the Supreme Court decision last month that gave local leaders greater authority to remove homeless campers. Of course, we talked about that Supreme Court decision at length. It was the Grants Pass case out of Oregon, which we were all on the West Coast in particular watching very closely because the Supreme Court had to decide whether it amounted to cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to our Constitution to remove people who are sleeping outside from encampments. The Supreme Court said that's not cruel and unusual punishment. And so what did we say at the time? That the ruling could be incredibly significant for West Coast cities in particular, struggling with homelessness, if they have the political will to act on it. Well, Governor Gavin Newsom today says he does indeed have the political will to act on it. Here's a video he posted.
I don't think there's anything more urgent and more frustrating than addressing the issue of encampments in the state of California. In the course of the last number of years, the state has stepped up, where in the past we provided no support, no resources to cities and counties to clean up encampments like this. Today, we've invested now over $1 billion in encampment resolution grants, not only to clean up sites like this, but to address the underlying issue in the first place. One of the big issues, though, that has been an impediment was the courts. In the past, the courts have denied the ability for local government, including the state, to clean up many of these encampments. Today, I announced an executive order to move the process forward. We're done. It's time to move with urgency at the local level to clean up these sites, to focus on public health and focus on public safety. There are no longer any excuses. $1 billion this state has invested to support communities to clean up these encampments. We have now no excuse with the Supreme Court decision. This executive order is about pushing that paradigm further and getting the sense of urgency that's required of local government to do their job.
Yeah, I would have been impressed with that if he said it 5 years ago, 6 years ago. If anyone in California had taken a forceful position on it, because a lot of what he says in that video is just an outright lie. And it's kind of gross, honestly, that he's having this video after all of this and how bad things have gotten in California. He's out there picking up trash. Like, look at me, you know, rolling up my sleeves and picking up trash. I would have been impressed with that had he done it years ago. Some of the things he said in there that are just outright falsehoods. First of all, the courts did not prevent you from solving the homelessness crisis. They did not. Certainly in Washington state, one of the rulings that we've had to work with is the ruling out of Idaho, out of Boise, Idaho, that said basically you can't remove someone from a tent on the street unless you have shelter to give them, which I think is fair because where are they going to go? They're just going to take their tent. They're going to set up somewhere else. And so what would happen is police would go out time and time again. They'd offer access to services and shelter. And when someone wouldn't take it, they had the legal authority to remove them. So California has not been completely hamstrung by the courts, where it's like just because of the Supreme Court ruling, now they can finally go out and do all this. And by the way, and clean up trash. He's out there cleaning up trash. There has never been a court ruling that precluded the state of California, the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, or any other state in the union from cleaning up trash from public spaces, along highways, under bridges, in public parks. So that's never something that should have been able to get so bad. The courts always have to do with the person, not the trash that you're out there cleaning up. So that's ridiculous. And then he talks about, you know, there's no excuses anymore. There's been no room for excuses up to this point. So you can say, oh, no excuses. We're going to get this done. Like, you should have been doing it years ago. The excuses ran out years ago. And then he wants to say, we've now invested $1 billion in trying to solve homelessness. You should not be proud of that. The reason you've had to give more than $1 billion in California to addressing the homeless crisis is because the homeless crisis has gotten so bad. That's what we see in Washington state as well. Remember, Governor Jay Inslee touted his right-of-way initiative, where the state was going to go in and finally clear these encampments that just lined state highways. And then we found out, we crunched the numbers, did a little bit of math, and we found out that it was costing them $1 million per person to remove them from a state right-of-way and get them out of homelessness. And one of the reasons they spent so much on that program is because homelessness has gone completely unmanaged and unchecked in Washington state for more than a decade. It's been slowly getting worse. Everyone with a brain saw it. People who were reasonable said, we have to do something about it. We were called NIMBYs. Oh, not in my backyard. You just don't like looking at homeless people. No, we don't like looking at our fellow human beings living in filth and squalor with needles in their arm. Call me right wing, but I just don't think that's very empathetic. So no, Gavin Newsom does not get credit for now all of a sudden saying, oh, the Supreme Court is letting us do what we should have been doing for the past 10 years. This just allows you to do it with more ease. This just allows you to do it more quickly. And so better now than never, but you don't get credit for that. There are also some limitations to what Gavin Newsom can do. From the New York Times, in his executive order, Mr. Newsom advised California cities and counties on how best to ramp up enforcement on a signature issue of his administration. He cannot force them to take action, but can exert political pressure through billions of dollars the state controls for municipalities to address homelessness. The order also expanded to other state agencies, an approach that the California Department of Transportation has used to clear encampments alongside freeways in the state. Mr. Newsom mandated that state officials not simply move campers along, but also work with local governments to house people and provide services into which the state has pumped billions of dollars. And that is the correct approach. Again, it's just all of this is way too late. And forgive me if I take it personally. I'm going back now 10, 15 years in Seattle as a journalist. Every single time, even when I was a mainstream journalist, that we did stories on how bad the homeless crisis was, we'd be called, oh, right wing, Fox News, lady hates the homeless, racist, whatever it was. Remember when Como News came out with the Seattle is Dying documentary? Nicole, can you Google what year Seattle is Dying came out? Because like Seattle was bad when that happened, but Seattle is much worse now. But remember how Eric Johnson at Como was vilified for the documentary Seattle is Dying? Oh, it's a piece of right wing propaganda when it was just video. Did you find it?
2019.
That was 5 years ago. He was vilified for just showing video of what Seattle looked like, for just showing video of people in the depths of despair and addiction. Eric Johnson was more vilified for showing someone using drugs and suffering from that than like the left vilified drug use. Think about that for a second. Like they're more angry at Eric in 2019 with Como for showing the drug use than they are with the government for not dealing with the drug use and for just letting people die on our streets. So no, I'm not just going to act like, great job, Gavin Newsom, like everything's fine. No, you have accountability that you have to have for the way things have been and how bad the homeless crisis has gotten in California, the same in Oregon, because what did we talk about last month in Oregon? Well, we had voters in Oregon who legalized hard drugs in 2020 or 2021. Then they ended up reversing it because that was a disaster. We gave them credit for the decision to reverse that. But that doesn't mean that they're off the hook for the thousands of people who've overdosed since drugs were legalized in that, like, the lost people in those 4 years in Oregon. And then you have the mayor of Portland, Wheeler, who is all about like, oh, hands-off approach to drugs, to homelessness, to rioting, all of that. And then all of a sudden he has an epiphany. I gave him credit, like, welcome to team common sense, but you got to give us a mea culpa and you have to learn from your mistakes and understand how things got so bad. You don't just get to wipe your hands and say, nope, it wasn't me. Now I'm like the savior. And in an election year, Gavin Newsom, you know what I really think it is? I don't hate to do it. I'm all in these conspiracies lately because it's like they always turn out to be true. One of the biggest knocks about Kamala Harris, the presumptive nominee for Democrats for the presidency, is that she is a California lady, that it would be Californication for the entire country. And even Democrats across the country, their brand of being a Democrat, their brand of liberal is not California's. And they don't want to look like California. The failures in California are known across the country. So could it be Gavin Newsom is trying to help his friend Kamala Harris by making sure California is the media is painting California as being on the right track, as being tough on homelessness and tough on drugs and tough on crime in the months leading up to a very important election for Kamala Harris? I don't think that's too far outside the realm of possibility. And I should also note that, you know, when you look at how bad the homeless crisis has gotten, and Gavin Newsom says, we're going to go in and we're going to clear up these camps, that's fine. But there's a lot more to it than that. Our homeless crisis on the West Coast isn't just bad because it's pretty here and the weather's nice and people want to come here and be homeless and you know, the access to services and all of that stuff. It's much deeper than that. There's homelessness elsewhere in the country, but it's way worse here. That's indisputable. So yes, the policies around the access to services is certainly part of it. But it's the way in which there's a hands-off law enforcement approach to people who are out there living on the streets, doing drugs in the throes of a mental health crisis. Nobody's out there saying, hey, we're going to force you into treatment. We're going to make sure that you get help for your mental illness. But you can't sit here on the corner of Third and Pine screaming at tourists. We're not going to allow that. So there's this really permissive environment up and down the West Coast that has allowed these issues to become so severe, so complex, to soak up billions and billions and billions of dollars in taxpayer funds. And no one, from Jay Inslee to Gavin Newsom, gets to all of a sudden claim that they're on top of it. And Bob Ferguson, spare me. He's running for governor, our attorney general. He has been permissive of all of this. He's never come out in the last 12 years and said, hey, Democrats, you know, as a leading Democrat, we really ought to be doing more. This isn't empathetic. Our state looks horrible. We need to do something. And now he's running for governor and he's running ads suggesting, like, I'm the guy for the job. Give me a break. Give me a break. So it's good that Gavin Newsom is utilizing the Supreme Court ruling. We'll see how it goes, right? But don't be fooled. Please don't be fooled to think that he's doing something righteous or he's leading the way across the United States. No, that is a crisis that has brewed for decades because of failed leadership, including his own failed leadership as a lifelong politician in the state of California. I asked you guys in a daily subscriber poll. I'll get to it later on. So make sure if you're a subscriber, you go take that poll before we get to questions and comments, whether you think Jay Inslee will follow suit. Because Jay seems to kind of do what Gavin does. It's like he's got his walkie-talkie. He's like, hey, Gavin, it's Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington. And I'm just, you know, I don't know how to do this job. And so I'm just waiting to see what you do. And I saw you did this thing on homelessness. Beep, beep, beep. Should I do it too? Boop. So go take that poll. And then let's see if Washington State will take a more aggressive stance in an election year on clearing some of the homeless encampments. Not the last time we're going to talk about that story. All right. Also talking about sanity. Look, I welcome all of this. Great. I want a better path. I just don't want the people who put us in these positions to fool voters into thinking that they've turned over a new leaf, especially not during an election year. So the news came out late last night. It is such welcome news that the King County Superior Court is going to be taking steps to deal with our massive eviction backlog, at least in King County. It doesn't help you if you're a landlord outside of King County, but usually when King County does something, other counties and the state will follow suit. So a letter was sent out from King County Superior Court saying they were implementing changes to address the eviction backlog. We know some landlords are waiting more than a year to even have their eviction cases heard. Effective August 12th, there will be a new process for unlawful detainer hearings, which are heard in the court's ex parte department. The court is expanding the calendar for unlawful detainer hearings, implementing new screening protocols, and increasing the number of judicial officers available to conduct such hearings. Under the new system, unlawful detainer actions will proceed via first and second show cause hearings. All hearings will continue to be on Zoom. The number of available hearing slots for the first unlawful detainer show cause hearing will start and expand through steady increases over the next several months with a target of 50 cases per calendar. So they see that there's a problem. They recognize that there's a problem. There was a quote in there from Judge K2 Shaw, but rather than read that quote for you, we invited him on the show today to discuss these changes. Judge Shaw, welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you for making some changes. I think there's a lot of housing providers who have been very, very frustrated with the state of things, who are breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief today. Can you just articulate for us what the most critical of those changes will be?
I think the biggest takeaway is that we're trying to increase capacity to give people access to our courts. So to have more hearings and more quickly, because we've been overwhelmed by the number of filings coming into our court. And we can only do so many hearings in a given session or calendar, if you will. And so what we're trying to do is triage the cases, the ones that need longer hearings, we're sort of setting out to individual judges. The ones that have shorter hearings, our commissioners will handle, and they'll have increased calendars to hear those shorter matters so that we can just kind of more quickly process cases and really give everybody access to our courts.
Was this a decision you were able to make on an island on your own without any approval from anyone else?
Well, we, as a third branch of government, you know, control our operations, and our operations are dictated by resources, budget that is granted by the legislative branch and the executive branch. And so we have been advocating for additional resources. We testified at the state legislature in January to advocate for additional resources statewide, because there are other courts in other cities that are facing similar issues. And then we advocated at the local level for resources as well. So we are working with our existing resources, but we believe that this is not going to fully help us catch up with the backlog and also deal with the increased number of filings. And so we are also in a budget cycle and asking for additional resources, both commissioners and judicial officers, as well as staff.
So just so I understand correctly, you're making these changes using your existing resources. Does that mean that your pleas in Olympia and locally, you did not get additional resources as you'd requested?
In Olympia, it did not get out of committee. And so we're going to advocate again this next session. It was a short session last January. This next session is a longer session. So we're hoping to advocate again. With the county council, they and the executive, they've been very receptive to our needs. We provided them the data and the information. And so we're in those conversations. Obviously, there are limited resources, and so difficult decisions have to be made. But we are making the case that this is an access to justice issue, access to the courts. Both tenants and landlords need these issues resolved in an orderly and timely way. And that's why we need to increase our capacity.
So if you haven't gotten any additional resources, you know, you're working on that end, but you've still been able to make these changes, the natural question is going to be, why didn't you make the changes sooner?
Well, we have, as we saw, the filings come increased. Part of our change of operations is to make sure we're not reacting to just a temporary blip as opposed to a trend. And so as we saw the trend develop, and that's been about, you know, a few months now, we have been working internally with our operations. We have a rulemaking process, a clerk's notice process. We have to make sure we create the calendars. So it just takes time to create the capacity internally, that structural organization. We are able to do that because we have some funding from the CLFR, the federal funding, that allows us to have some staff to deal with evictions. That funding will expire at the end of this year. So we wanted to make sure we took advantage of that funding now and try to increase that capacity, hopefully developing a pilot, if you will, to see that this will work, and so that it'll persuade our funders that this is money well invested to continue this process.
And this might be a difficult question to answer, but if you're able to give me a ballpark, what would this mean, just practically speaking, for a landlord or housing provider who has, you know, they're trying to push ahead with an eviction from a time perspective? For instance, we just had one on our show 2 weeks ago who said that his court date that he was given was March of 2025, which is obviously very frustrating for him. Can you give me any sense of how much this could shorten those wait times?
I think our hope is to make that quite a bit shorter, because you're right, that length of time for a hearing is extremely long. 6-8 months is just too long for people to wait. For both sides, I think they want some kind of finality of whatever the decision will be. So we're going to set a first hearing in 30 days and then a second hearing in 30 days. And then after that, we hope to get the, if it's still a contested hearing where they need more time in court, then we hope to get them in front of a judge or commissioner. So I'm hoping that we will cut this time in half. I can't promise that. It'll sort of, as we develop and as we see how this process works, but our goals are to substantially reduce the time necessary for these hearings to be adjudicated on the merits.
And will that start with the person who's been waiting in line the longest, or will you sort of triage new cases as they come in? Or is this going like back of the line, you get to be triaged first?
We're going to be triaging new cases first and then, you know, see how that goes. And then as we get a handle on these calendars and figure out our capacity, then we might try to go to the cases that are pending and those that are waiting the longest, try to move them up. But that process, again, is just, you know, organizationally, we have to kind of work through those calendars, work through those cases. And it takes staff hours, it takes organizational ability. And so that's why getting this in place took us some time. And now as we do it, we're going to learn as we go and then make improvements moving forward.
And Judge Shaw, I know we just have a couple more minutes with you. I appreciate you squeezing us in today on this because it's such a critical issue. So I'll end here. One of the concerns that's been brought to us by housing providers is you have a system through policy where the tenants get free attorneys. And I mean, I don't know that they have an issue per se with them getting free attorneys, but they feel like when they finally get in front of someone for their case to be heard, the housing justice provided attorneys seem to be dead set on delaying things as far as they can for their clients. Have you seen intentional efforts to delay these cases as long as possible?
I have not. You know, whenever we get a request for a continuance, we get this in all aspects of our court, whether it's a eviction type of case or a criminal case. An attorney will ask for a continuance because they need more time to prepare. Part of the analysis for us is, how much time do they need? When did they come on the case? Or what have they done to the point of when they asked for the continuance? And then we make those individual determinations. And so oftentimes we get an attorney who comes in maybe at the last moment and said, oh, my client just reached out to me. I've just been retained. I need some time to prepare. Or in this case, an attorney has been appointed just recently. And so the attorney needs time to prepare. We, of course, want attorneys to be prepared. It makes the hearings go faster and be more efficient. So we will grant a continuance. If there is some intentional delay, so to speak, as you mentioned, then we look at that and we will deny motions to continue if that information surfaces to us. We don't assume that. It has to be presented to us. And then once we look at the facts and individual circumstances of the case, we make that kind of decision. In our process that we've just implemented, our hope is to get that screening done for counsel earlier in the process. So that way that person can get an attorney earlier, and then they can begin preparing for whatever defense or rights they want to litigate.
All right, Judge Shaw, we appreciate your time. And I'll tell you what, you go to Olympia next session and they're not giving you money, you just get in touch with us. And we'll complain about it on the show until they open up their pocketbooks, okay?
Appreciate the conversation today and anytime.
Thank you.
Appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, we'll ask them to open up their pocketbooks as long as the money's going to be well spent. I mean, we need to get landlords out of the situation that they're in. It's ridiculous. And it's similar to what we just talked about with Gavin Newsom. You wait till the problem's that bad before you do something about it. How many, we've been screaming from the rooftops for a year and a half about how bad the situation was with evictions, you know, going all the way back to that Seattle landlord who we had on the show multiple times, who was dealing with a ridiculous situation. There are so many things, and I would say in Washington State in particular, where it's like, you know, Jaskaran Singh in Bellevue, he had to hold protests for how many Saturdays in a row? Did Jaskaran Singh hold protests outside the home where there's a guy living there who hasn't paid rent in 2 years, despite getting his rent covered by the taxpayers? It's insane. So part of me wonders, is it the public pressure campaign that has finally forced King County's hand? Or did they just wait until it was like screaming in their face so bad they couldn't ignore it anymore? So I'm glad they're doing something. As I told Judge Shaw, I'm glad they're taking some steps. It's just a year or 2 years too late. And also, reasonable people should have been able to anticipate when we had these long, drawn-out eviction moratoriums during the pandemic that when those ended, there was going to be a backlog of evictions and our system was going to be overburdened. So it's just an example of either government incompetence, intentional incompetence, it might be a little bit of the two, or just not caring, I guess. Just it, you know, you have the Housing Justice Project, they're letting people live in people's homes for free and they're pushing the justice for all narrative. Maybe that's what they want. I don't know. But it's ridiculous. So I'm not going to sit here and celebrate people who are doing what they need to do a year or 10 years too late. It's important for voters to remember that. And I also don't know how much of this is because it's an election year. There is, you look at Jaskaran Singh, someone who Democrats, as an Indian immigrant to this country from India, who Democrats probably think, oh, we got his vote in the bag. Well, now he's running for state Senate as a Republican. So maybe they see that and they think, oh, this eviction stuff isn't, oh, it's not going over so well for us. We're losing voters. So King County, can you guys, I don't know, fix that? And then the narrative for us going into an important election will be like, no, we're taking steps to fix that right now. We've got that handled. So vote for us again and we'll do better. I'm sick of them saying that they'll do better in election years only. Election year courage. Least courageous of all the types of courage that there is. All right, if you're in the market to sell your home, maybe you're a landlord and you're not dealing with the crazy anymore and you are going to take your unit out of the rental pool, you know, lack of available housing, be damned. Democrats say that we need more housing and they do this to landlords and you don't think landlords are going to turn around and sell their units to someone who's just going to live in it? Ridiculous. So if that's you, reach out to our friend Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com. He'll happily help you out. Wes has been a real estate agent in this market for a long time, and he says despite the fact that rates are still high, now is an advantageous time for sellers.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October. And then as the election starts to come up, you know, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, you know, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. You know, it's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, what are you waiting for? 100%. So reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. And just as I was saying that, Captain Cranky Pants in the YouTube live chat says, I sold my wall rentals. So yeah, I think there's some landlords who are just going to turn around, sell those homes out of the rental market, but I don't blame them. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, we've been talking about the youth crime crisis, 13, 14, 15-year-olds committing violent crimes. Well, how about a 7-year-old? Let's discuss in our segment, Unbelievable. We're failing kids. We're failing kids. Society is failing kids. And I'll just say, you know, I don't think we know the races of the kids involved. We'll probably find out. But one of the things I'll say is a lot of the youth violence that we're seeing is from young Black men. And I have said that I blame politicians at the highest levels of government all the way down. I blame schools. I blame community leaders for this consistent narrative since 2020 that says the color of your skin is a hindrance to you being able to do anything productive with your life because the system is designed to keep you down. I really do. We should be lifting these kids up, and we should be telling them that your skin's not going to hold you back. Like, not in 2024 in America. You can be whatever you want to be, as a side note. So this headline from King 5 News makes me sick to my stomach. Group of juveniles, including a seven-year-old, wanted for robbery in North Seattle. It says, on Monday, five 15-year-old girls were riding a King County Metro bus. They were heading south. A group of 10 juveniles between the ages of 7 and 17 got on the bus. Police said they began to make biased comments about the girls' race and privilege. Gee. I mean, again, like I haven't, I mean, who? Okay, you know. The teen girls decided to get off the bus because they felt intimidated, according to Seattle police. Well, the suspects followed them and surrounded them after they got off the bus. The suspects demanded money using foul language. At one point, a suspect believed to be around 7 years old was brandishing a hatchet. This made the victims fear for their safety, you think? So one of them opened up their handbag, after which one of the suspects, who had a baby on her hip, stole their cash. So you're talking about a group of juveniles that includes young boys and even apparently one young woman under the age of 17 who had a baby on her hip. While she helped rob these 15-year-old girls. The girls started walking away and using their phones when the suspects started chasing them. They fled to a nearby ice cream shop where they called the police. Failure of our system from the top to the bottom. That's insane. A 17-year-old even, frankly. So a group, about 10 juveniles ages 7 to 17, robbing some teenage girls who had to flee to an ice cream shop. And one of the suspects had a baby with her. Yeah, real great job, Seattle. Real great job. It says, in the past, there have been several high-profile cases involving teenagers. A 15-year-old shot and killed in West Seattle at a teen life center. A 17-year-old shot and killed at Garfield High School. In the weeks and months since those teen shootings, law enforcement and at least one city council member, Rob Saka, the man who yesterday said police defunding is dead, it's a shameful legacy, thank you, Councilmember Saka, he has said that a state law, and this is a new state law, passed during the whole police defunding movement, it prevents these cases from being solved. Remember, we just had a chief of police for Linwood on the show, who, after a 13-year-old girl was murdered at a mall in Linwood, came on, and he talked about this exact law. Rob Saka said before it wasn't required. Now, if the cops want to search a teen's backpack, they have to be able to consult with an attorney to give consent to that. If those kids are detained and police want to question them, those kids have to have access to a lawyer first. What typically happens, and it's understandable for defense attorneys to say this, no, my client doesn't want to talk. So again, it's that law that was passed that absolutely prohibits police from being able to interview minors until they reach out, make sure an attorney's present. And then you have these precious minutes that pass by. In the case of the Linwood shooting, you know, what the chief told us up there, you've got juveniles pulled out a handgun. There was a dispute. An innocent 13-year-old girl is shot and killed. And for a while, they didn't even know where the gun was. And they wouldn't be able to figure out, is that gun in the hands of someone, a teenager who's going to continue to use it to harm other people? So you put a pause on the whole thing. Also, this is actually news to me, I knew that there was an age under which you basically could not be held accountable for your crimes, but Casey McNerthy with King County Prosecutor's Office said state law on this is clear when it comes to that seven-year-old. State law says if you're younger than eight, you're incapable of committing a crime in Washington. If you're between the ages of 8 and 12, you're presumed to be incapable. So that would mean the prosecution would have the burden of proof to prove that you are capable of understanding the charges against you. So we've talked about this before, right? That is why older gang members use younger kids. 100%. those kids, that seven-year-old, other kids who are, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, they're being used as pawns, as puppets, to commit crimes because state law says they're incapable of understanding their actions. So you might have a 16, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old gang member who says, hey, I could rob this person, or you could come with me, you grab it. If we get caught, you're the one who's going to get in trouble, but it's not going to be much trouble because they can't actually charge you with the crime. You don't think that gang members are doing that? And then you've got these teen gang members, or even in their 20s, we talked about on the show yesterday, who then, you know, think, we shouldn't get in trouble. Like, we're just nice young, there was the murderer we talked about on the show yesterday who's mad that he has to spend a couple years in an adult prison for committing a homicide. And then you have Democrats who fall, they're just kids. Oh, that 19-year-old gang member who killed someone, that's just a kid. We can't throw him in an adult prison. Well, that 19-year-old gang member has probably done what other 19-year-old gang members have done, and they've probably used even younger kids to commit their crimes to try to get away with criminal behavior. So that's what's going on here. And then, of course, parenting. Parenting failure up and down the board. But the lack of consequences is a real big one. We discussed this on the show yesterday. And despite all of this, despite a clear and present youth crime crisis, young people dying on our streets, young people killing other young people, there is still this desire from the party in power in Washington state to treat them like they're not criminals, to take it easy on them. Think about that. You say you care about, like, let's just use, like, this 17-year-old, right? Let's say, oh, the 17-year-old gang member committed a drive-by shooting. We want to coddle and cradle them. And, you know, they're not real criminals and we want to put them on a better path. Yet the person they shot at was probably a juvenile as well. Where's the care and concern for their life, for their safety, for their survival? No, it's always about the criminal, right? So despite the crime crisis, unbelievable, despite what's still going on, King County is still considering closing the youth jail. They're still debating it. They won't table it. This is something King County Executive Dow Constantine just came up with when everybody was protesting against the police and demanding racial justice. He's like, I'll close the youth jail. I think it was like by 2025 or something. He had a goal. And I don't know if he's going to continue to try to stick to that goal or not. But the King County Council is still entertaining it. This from the Seattle Times. King County Council Committee remains deadlocked on youth jail's future. Like, I'm glad they're deadlocked, but you shouldn't even be voting on it. You shouldn't even be having hearings about it. We shouldn't even be entertaining this conversation anymore. It says a Metropolitan King County Council Committee voiced its indecision for keeping the county's youth detention center open, yet again punting a vote on whether members support keeping it open. The center opened in early 2020, but months later, amid that summer's unprecedented racial justice protests, Constantine announced he would close the detention facility by 2025. It says the majority of children held in secure detention are charged with serious or violent offenses. Many children with less serious cases are placed on electronic home monitoring rather than be detained. Over 100 people appeared Wednesday for the public comment. The majority expressed opposition to closing the jail, citing the lack of resources put toward community support to prevent crime. It says the state requires King County to operate a juvenile detention facility, and closing the detention center at some point could require both judicial approval and changes from the legislature. And one of the key arguments, they say, in the statistics in here, that on average about half the kids at the youth detention facility are Black, compared with 7% of King County's population being Black. So there's clearly a disproportionate amount of Black youth in the detention facility compared to Black youth as a percentage of the population. But that doesn't mean that it's racist outcomes. That could just mean that there are more Black youth committing crimes. That does just mean that there are more Black youth committing crimes. They're in gangs. They're doing these things. You can call that racist. I don't care. I work for myself. You can't fire me. I said something similar when I was on Fox 13 and the internet just lost it. They were like, fire her. She's racist. All this stuff. Fire me now. Can't do it. Because when you have that big of a discrepancy, 50% of the Black youth of the detained youth in the youth jail are Black versus 7% of the population, you are telling me you don't want to fix the problem if you're contributing that to racism. That just plain and simple. I mean, we have a 7-year-old who's out there on a bus with kids harassing and robbing 15-year-olds with a hatchet. Failure in parenting, failure in opportunity, messaging from the top to the bottom that Black kids can't become anything because the system and the white man is holding them down. So we have to fix that. And I'm not saying that it doesn't have its roots in racism. I've said this on the show a million times. I do believe slavery in this country, the implications of slavery are still very clear. I think slavery robbed Black Americans of the ability to build generational wealth. And I think a lot of the reasons that young Black men turn to a life of crime is a lack of economic opportunity and economic inequality at home, 100%. So we have to figure out, how do we get into Black neighborhoods? How do we, from the top down, message that, no, you can be anything you want in this country? The system isn't going to hold you down. It's going to give you opportunities. It's up to you to take advantage of those opportunities. How do we help Black people in this country build generational wealth? So those are all conversations we need to have. But I refuse to buy into the narrative that we have to close a youth jail simply because there are more Black people in that jail than they are a percentage of the population. That won't make things better. That will make things much, much worse. Unbelievable that we're still having those conversations. All right, if you're trying to save money, which I know a lot of you are right now, I mean, the economy isn't great. Cost of gas, cost of groceries, everything is just putting pressure on families. So you might be looking at what you can cut. Well, you can't cut your insurance. You need insurance. But can you be saving money on your insurance? Are you trying to deal with that on your own? You know, plugging in what you need into a tool and it spitting out a price in 7 seconds. I promise you, we can do better than that. It's called FirstMark Insurance. FirstMarkInsurance.com. They're a wonderful real estate broker that's been working in Washington State for some time. I'm a member of the FirstMark family, and it's because they offer a superior service and they take so much pressure off of you for trying to figure out if you have the best price and an insurance plan and policy that meets your needs. We've heard from so many members of the Undivided family that are now members of the FirstMark family as well. Maggie says FirstMark was able to get her a new bundle that was half the cost on her home and auto, and it was better coverage. Casey in Covington says he did the FirstMark challenge. They saved him 37% off his auto quote. So you're talking about hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year in some instances. So don't wait. Take the FirstMark challenge today. All right, enough of this West Coast craziness. It's Thursday. You know what that means? We boop, take a visit all the way to the Sunshine State. It's our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Hello, Miranda. Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday.
Not so happy for at least 90 people in the state of Florida who are being named and shamed for misusing COVID-19 funds. Still finding them, eh?
Yeah, they're still finding them. They added 5 more to the list just recently, so it makes it 94 to be exact, 67 of which have actually been charged and prosecuted, and there's 27 still going through the ringer, but they are naming and shaming them. A lot of these people took, it's a total of, with all these people, it's a total of $84 million being misused. Like, there's one guy this article talked about that bought like a brand new Jaguar car. People are buying luxury homes, designer handbags. And when they're getting named and shamed, they're letting us know what they decided to buy with these emergency funds that were given out during COVID.
God, I love that so much. I mean, I don't love that they abused him, but basically they got money from the federal government to help them through COVID, didn't spend it in the way that they said that they were going to spend it as part of getting that money. Put them in prison, the bottom line. Yeah. Although I'll say you're still better off than our state, because what was the final total? Was it $1 billion that Nigerian scammers took from our unemployment system? So... We did much worse.
I hope those went to help some local people in Nigeria, because maybe they're using it for things like food and not Lamborghinis and Jaguars. But I was worried. I took a very small amount because I just didn't know what I was going to need. And I absolutely used it to help me get through. And I had bought, like, my camera had, you know, broke just before the new COVID thing. I got a new camera and I was so nervous. I'm like, is this an emergency fund? Like, I was terrified they were going to come down on me. So I like kept the receipt and like kept my broken camera because I was so worried. And meanwhile, people are buying homes and cars.
Well, you got money to help your business, which is photography, and bought a new camera. So I think that you're probably safe there. If not, come and get her. Come and get her. All right, this is an odd one, and I have mixed feelings about this. So we just went through this whole thing allowing college athletes to profit from their image and likeness, as opposed to waiting until they hit the pros. And now in Florida, CBS News reports, a plan has been ratified allowing Florida high school athletes high school athletes to be paid for their personal brands.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this has a lot to do with the influence that social media has on our world right now. A lot of these kids probably have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of followers on Instagram through being amazing at different high school sports. So they're getting offered deals for endorsements and all types of things. And they haven't been able to take advantage of those offers until just recently. I think there's a lot of I think people are wary about it because these are all minors. Like if you're in high school, chances are you're probably under the age of 18. So, you know, making sure kids aren't going to be taken advantage of or exploited is going to be something they're going to have to take, keep a keen eye out for. And then also high schools that maybe have like super stacked teams can't use these opportunities to recruit players into the school either. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how they're going to keep an eye on stuff like that, but I have mixed feelings about it too, because I don't see why a kid shouldn't be able to profit off something they're good at. Mm. But at the end of the day, they're still minors. So I just don't know where you draw the line at that.
Yeah, the decision was made by the State Board of Education. It goes to the Florida High School Athletic Association. And they said they do still need to figure out some additional protections, like for the reasons you articulated. I guess I have two big concerns. I understood the college one because the NCAA profits off of them. So when you have someone else profiting off your image and likeness and you're prohibited from profiting off of it, that's not fair. But to the best of my knowledge, high school teams aren't profiting off of their athletes. So this it concerns me for that reason. Is I don't know that it's necessary for the reasons it was necessary in college, but I also wonder if you've got, you know, some of the standout star athletes across the country in high school. You know, you always hear are they going to skip college and go to the pros, and they're like the really good high school athletes who people actually know. I worry that they'll skip it altogether because they're making, you know, what they think is good money off social media. And it's not good money and it's not long term. And they're going to make poor decisions based on a temporary financial gain that they might pass up in education or something like that. So I don't think I like it. I've decided.
I agree with you.
Not a fan. All right. There is a very sad individual bear in Florida moping along the highway, and the Florida sheriff in this county, Walton County, says please stop taking selfies with the sad, depressed bear.
Yeah, it's apparently sad bear season in Florida right now, where they're just kind of, some male bears are reaching a state of maturity where they're just trying to find their place in bear society. So this particular bear has been trying to find his place in Fort Myers. And he's just been kind of wandering around the side of a highway and by a Dunkin' Donuts. And people keep stopping on the highway to get out and take pictures with a bear. And the sheriff is like, it is still a bear. He might be sitting there sad and depressed, but he still might do bear things. So he's trying to get people to leave this poor guy alone and let him figure his life out.
First of all, this might be embarrassing. I didn't realize you had bears in Florida.
Okay, I didn't either. When I first moved down here, I didn't think we had anything as big as a pig or a cow. But we have jaguars, we have bears, we have coyotes and foxes.
You have jaguars?
So they're okay. People refer to them as jaguars or panthers, but yeah, we have them here.
Oh, that makes sense, because the Florida Panthers. Yes. Remember, I think it was me. One of us had, you remember the starter jackets, right?
Yeah.
Nicole, do you remember starter jackets? Come on. You didn't have a starter jacket? With like a sports team on it? No, it was like a winter coat with a sports team on it.
Okay.
Yeah. No? So we had, did I have the Florida Panthers one?
I know
you had Florida Panthers, and I had the Miami Dolphins one.
And our brother had Chicago Bulls. That's so funny. You had a Miami Dolphins one. You love Dolphins. Then you ended up moving to, and because you love Dolphins, you like Dan Marino because the Dolphins, right? And then you ended up moving to Miami, and I had a huge collection, wow, we're off track, of Sean Kemp cards. Sean Kemp supersonic cards. I gave them to a boy I liked in the fourth grade, should have kept them. And then later on in life, when I moved to Seattle, that's weird, right? I met Sean Kemp, and I told him when I was in second grade through fourth grade, I collected your cards. And he said, please don't ever tell anybody that again. It makes me feel old.
You know, I had met Dan Marino too. by chance, I was photographing a house and he happened to be there. And I told him, I used to be obsessed with you and I collected all of your Dan Marino cards. And he's like, because he's got like a deep Batman voice, he's like, do you still have them? And I'm like, I actually don't know.
Do you want to go on a date, Miranda?
I would have said yes.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you would have. Anyway, don't take pictures with a depressed bear along the highway. He's just chilling. So, okay, blast from the past there. I'm sure a million people are going to comment now about what starter jacket. That's what we want to know. What starter jacket did you have when you were a kid? And then somebody else in our family had the Charlotte Hornets. Is Charlotte Hornets, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it Tim? My brother maybe had it. Anyway, I think my mom, whatever was on sale, like we just got, it was like totally random teams. So anyway, okay, Miranda, thank you.
Have a good weekend.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Oh, man, I've done it now. We've started a whole debate in the chat about what starter jackets everyone had. That thing was stylish. I don't know. You know what's old is new again? I'm sure there are some people who have vintage starter jackets and now it's a thing. And...
Oh, I was looking online there. Oh. 180, I thought.
Man, yeah. I know my parents didn't spend 180 on it. So, all right. I'm not going to apologize for something I said yesterday. I was wrong. I can't predict the future, but I had said, you know, there were these anti-Israel protesters who were in the nation's capital in the rotunda, and they were singing and chanting, and there were conservatives saying, oh, they're insurrectionists. And I said, those aren't insurrectionists. I am perfectly fine with people protesting in the Capitol. And you can't compare that to January 6th because they weren't assaulting police officers and breaking windows and scaling walls, et cetera, et cetera. But I did say that I know that since Benjamin Netanyahu was in town and was addressing a joint session of Congress, they were bringing in additional officers and we would wait and see how things went. Well, things did not go well. And the terrorist sympathizers absolutely destroyed areas of our nation's capital, monuments. They absolutely assaulted police officers. So I once again saw conservative media saying that, oh, these are, you know, insurrectionists, et cetera, et cetera. No, these are terrorists. These are terrorists. And, you know, and the left's like, Brandy, they're not terrorists. I didn't know that graffiti was terror activity. Well, they didn't just do graffiti. Again, there were examples of them burning American flags, assaulting police officers. Their goal is to terrorize, and they sympathize with a terrorist organization. They are very much in support of what Hamas is doing. You don't spray paint elegies to Hamas up on, you know, the monuments unless you support what Hamas is doing. It's disgusting to see the American flag being taken down, people trying to hoist the Palestinian flag up, the American flag being burned, people assaulting Capitol police officers. It is absolutely no better than what happened on January 6th. And to treat it any different is absolutely ridiculous. The folks who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, they had an agenda, right? They wanted to, in my opinion, they did. They wanted to disrupt the certification of a presidential election. They were mad in the outcome of the presidential election. And that was terrible. Now you have people on the left who hate Jewish individuals and who support a terror organization, and they want to go ahead and disrupt a speech from the prime minister of, from the head of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's their goal. Is one better or one worse? It's both horrible. And then I saw Kamala Harris come out and she put out a statement, which again, I'm glad, but all you're seeing is election year courage. That's all you're seeing. It's election year courage. Because Kamala Harris, and in fact, can we play the clip first of Biden? So just a couple, maybe last week, a couple weeks ago, Biden was speaking to, I think it was the NAACP, and here's what he said about the protests in 2020.
Decimated small black businesses, and you peacefully protested George Floyd's murder. Donald Trump called for the National Guard to go after you. What in the hell's the matter with this man?
Yeah, he called it peaceful. And when he said decimated small businesses, he was talking about the pandemic, not about protesters. He was saying, oh, you're just protesting the murder of George Floyd and you were peaceful and Donald Trump wanted to send the National Guard after you. So Democrats have a long history of ignoring political violence unless it's violence that's from the other side or it's an election year and they feel like they have to say it. So here's a statement from Kamala Harris. Yesterday at Union Station in Washington, D.C., we saw despicable acts by unpatriotic protesters and dangerous hate-fueled rhetoric. I condemn any individuals associating with the brutal terrorist organization Hamas, which has vowed to annihilate the state of Israel and kill Jews. Pro-Hamas graffiti and rhetoric is abhorrent and we must not tolerate it in our nation. I condemn the burning of the American flag. That flag is a symbol of our highest ideals as a nation and represents the promise of America. It should never be desecrated in that way. I support the right to peacefully protest, but let's be clear, anti-Semitism, hate, and violence of any kind have no place in our nation. And that's not hard. Yet it has been very, very hard for Democrats, including Vice President Kamala Harris, to do that during other acts of left-wing violence. It's election year courage. And I don't find election year courage to be very courageous. Same is similar here in Washington State with Bob Ferguson. Now he wants to say he doesn't support police defunding. Now he wants to say he doesn't support eroding the ability of police to pursue dangerous suspects. Now he wants to act like he's the public safety guy. He wants to talk about the left-wing rioters blocking the interstate and stuff when he stayed silent for 12 years. Courage is doing or saying something when it's difficult. They choose to do or say something when it benefits them politically. That is absolutely not courage. All right, happening today in 2.5 hours, I can add and subtract and do math. Our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital is going to be having one of his live webinars on inflation. So you have worked hard and you're saving for your retirement. At least I hope you're saving for your retirement. And you probably have a vision in your mind, like Mike and I do, of what we want our retirement to look like. Our plan is to move to the middle of nowhere. I'm going to delete all my social media pages and we're going to have a rescue for old dogs or disabled dogs that no one wants to adopt. And they're just going to live out their lives in happiness and glory and they're going to swim and get all sorts of pets. So that's the retirement that we're planning for. But then inflation comes into play. And if you have a high inflationary environment, you've planned for a certain type of retirement, well, can you live out that plan or is inflation going to hurt it? So that's what Zach is going to be talking about today on his live webinar. It's happening 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. You can still sign up. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. He joins us today to talk about the kind of advice that they're going to be giving. So in a couple hours, you are having another one of your inflation webinars. People can still sign up. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. What are they going to learn?
The biggest thing they're going to learn, and you know, I think that you saw it yesterday with the pretty dramatic market sell-off, was if your portfolio got hit really hard, you fit the definition of what we're trying to warn people about, is this whole passive ETF investing craze that has taken over the retirement investment industry means that when those top stocks in the stock market tip over, which they're bound to do, and it's just, you know, I think what you saw yesterday is just a case of things getting irrationally expensive, your entire portfolio is going to get drugged down with it. And the pernicious part to it is if you believe that we have turned the corner into an inflationary environment, not only do you own way too much of that stuff, but you own a record low amount of stuff that has traditionally been considered a good inflation hedge. And so I feel like our argument's pretty benign. It's, hey, let's make a more traditionally diversified balanced portfolio rather than having this historically one-off glop of so much of our money in one sector. And we're going to break that down and show them exactly what we mean, that it's not anecdotal, it's not hyperbole. Just going to show them the facts and the stats and show them the way they're currently positioned and where they need to be.
Yeah. And for you, I mean, this stuff is easy. You could talk about this stuff in your sleep. I think for most people that goes right over their head. And I think just from a real like baseline thing, when I hear inflation, I guess one of the things I worry about, especially if I were to be closer to retirement, is like, you know, you plan your dreams, you save for your dreams, you're responsible, you have a goal, you have a vision of what you want your retirement to look like. But then it's like costs increase so much. And am I going to be able to live out the retirement that I dreamed of? So what would you say to people who haven't really factored that in and are a little bit concerned?
Yeah, I think first of all, I think that's a great way to say it. I probably should have had you just do this segment talking. But it's a perfect way to say it. One of the easiest ways to beat rising costs is to own the things that are going up, right? So if you own the things that are going up, you're going to benefit from those rising costs as opposed to being penalized by them. Right now, in in a traditionally managed retirement portfolio, you own less of the things that go up in inflation than you ever have in history. That is not hyperbole. That is just a fact. So what we're saying is you should probably own more of the things that go up in an inflationary environment, or at least own a historically normal amount of them, right? That would be a step in the right direction. But right now, based on what's gone on in the markets over the last 15 years, and more specifically the last five, you own the most of the things that get hit in inflationary environments, and you own the least of things that benefit.
So Zach's having that webinar today. You can get all his knowledge on inflation, how it impacts your retirement. Sign up. There's still some room. Totally virtual and free. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to KnowYourRiskRadio.com. And we shall go to our daily subscriber show poll. I asked you guys on Patreon, Locals, and X. In light of Gavin Newsom making an executive order to clear homeless camps across the state, do you think Governor Jay Inslee in Washington will follow suit? After all, old Jay Inslee, he just waits for a cue from Gavin Newsom for what Gavin's going to do. So do you think he is going to do it next? Yes or no? Not a lot of confidence, I will say. Like, I don't think Gavin's doing it for the right reasons. I still think, and I would be okay with Governor Inslee after all these years of failing on homelessness to go in a different direction. Lives are on the line, and the viability of our state and the success of our state is on the line. On Patreon, 71% saying no. Street says he no longer cares. He'll give the glory to Ferguson. Are the new sweeps going to need a place to go like Washington? Lord help us. And that's the thing, is like, you can sweep, but do you have a place for them to go? Do you have those services? We better hope, because you've spent billions of dollars and you've told us, not only in Washington, but in California, that's for services for the homeless. You damn well better have a place for them to go. Brandon Ferris says, we can only wish, but he's useless. Nicole, he does whatever Gavin does, so I said yes. But then again, he isn't running again, so who knows? That's true. I mean, Gavin Newsom isn't running again either, but he has, or maybe he, is he term limited out? I don't remember. I'd have to check on that. I'm not sure if that, because we don't have term limits in Washington, but I think his current term goes until 2026. So his doesn't end this year. But Jay Inslee's does. We have less than a year left of Jay Inslee after 12 years. Andy Stevens says yes to help out Bob Ferguson. And that's the only reason. Yeah, I could see Jay Inslee doing it so that Bob Ferguson has a more positive narrative on the homeless crisis going into his gubernatorial election. Let's see. Randall says, no, it would contradict his position that there are not enough affordable homes. Besides, your boy Jay doesn't do course correction very well. Yeah, Governor Inslee still won't admit that we didn't need a state of emergency for 975 days during the pandemic, or that the Climate Commitment Act is raising gas prices. Still not ready to admit that one, despite the fact that his own economist said it was raising gas prices. Kind of weird how that works. All right, let's get to other questions and comments before we get to our closing sanity check. It's a doozy today. Baron of Gray Matter with a $10 super chat. You lefties claim Trump is a threat to democracy, yet your party forced you to vote for Biden only. Democracy? Now they have forced him out and installed Kamala. Democracy? Really? You had no voice. Hey, even BLM said that this week. They said what Democrats are doing with Kamala Harris is anti-democracy. That's coming from BLM. That's not coming from me. Like, at least make it look like it's a competitive process, right? Please pretend. On California, Cindy Schutman says, spending money does not equal results. Why do politicians continually boast in terms of money spent on issues? And why do news agencies and voters not call them out on that 100%? It is nothing to brag about when you have to spend more than $1 billion on the homeless crisis. That means the homeless crisis is bad enough to have to spend $1 billion on. On the judge that we had on, the King County Superior Court judge, making some changes to try to reduce the eviction case backlog. Matthew Cook says, shortening the length of time to get a hearing is a good start, but until the Housing Justice Project is audited and investigated, there will be no incentive to stop those who are not paying rent. And I asked the judge that. Are you seeing housing justice attorneys intentionally try to delay cases so their clients can keep living somewhere rent-free for as long as they'd like? The judge says no. I don't know. I didn't even look to see if he's a political appointee or an elected judge. I appreciated him coming on the show. He said that if they did feel like someone was trying to needlessly delay a case, that they would reject those motions for a continuance. So we will see what happens. Matthew, I think you're 100% right that it's one thing to say this is what we're doing. We'll see how it works in practice. I'd also say for people like Jaskaran Singh, the Bellevue landlord who hasn't been given a rent check in 2 years, what I ask the judge is, are you going to triage people at the back of the line? Or are you going to, as new cases come in, speed those up? And it sounds like they're doing new cases. So it doesn't sound like this is going to, at least in the short term, help someone like Jaskaran Singh, which doesn't seem fair to me. Wouldn't you go at the people who've been waiting 2 years and triage those cases first? Very strange. On kid, now we'll call them kid crimes. They're not even teen crimes anymore. 7-year-old in Seattle wanted for robbery. Krista M., quote, the kids should ride the buses for free. Buses are safe. Yeah. How much Climate Commitment Act money is going to giving, quote unquote, free bus rides to youth? They're not free. They're taxpayer-funded bus rides. And they want to tell us, oh, it's totally safe. These 15-year-old girls who were robbed by a group, including a 7-year-old with a hatchet, were riding public transit. Like, it's not safe. And it's not. It hasn't been in some time.
They didn't catch them, and there was it. They seem fairly sure about their ages.
They seem to know who they are.
So I'm thinking that these kids have been running amok for a while, and so this is a problem.
It's insane. My mom was in town, and she was just doing a really quick layover on her way to Alaska and back. She'd like one day in Seattle there and back, and she's like, "Oh, well, I could take the train up to." I'm like, "Nope, no, you may not." No, you may not. I've taken the train a few places. I know you just took it down to a game and you thought it was fine.
It's a crowd of concert goers. Right. You can't fit in. And I think they purposely clear it out right before those events. But on a day-to-day, I don't think so.
They're drug dens. Jason Rance takes public transit all the time, which I think is so liberal of our friend Jason Rance. And he's always documenting just the horrible conditions of the bus stops, like overflowing with trash, like the tinfoil and stuff to do drugs and people on. It's just insane. So no, don't give children free bus rides until you can clean up the buses. And they're not free. I should stop
saying that.
And
make sure that there's not other teens on the bus trying to get them to do bad things. Like, right. That's a good place for them all to meet up.
Yeah, the 7-year-old didn't decide on his own to go out with a hatchet and rob some teenage girls, right? That was a decision forced upon him by older, horrible teenagers.
And he's not even allowed to babysitter, take care of himself. So who do his parents think he's hanging out with?
Yep. Insane. Yeah. Who, you don't send your 7-year-old out for like a playtime.
I don't alone.
No, that's insane. Mm-hmm. Weiscastle on juvenile crimes. I have no problem with some discretion for first time offenders, but has to be that you're on probation. There has to be a follow through, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, first time offense. Maybe that shouldn't ruin a kid's life, but are they taking steps to actively improve their circumstances? Or what is their attendance at school? I mean, you can have a probationary situation where your school attendance has to be at a certain level. Like a judge can mandate a lot of things as part of a sentencing. A judge has a lot of discretion to get creative. So we need to get creative with these kids. It starts with monitoring them and making sure that they're doing societally expected normal things for their age, right? Like, go join a basketball club. Like
the girls club.
I'd pay for it with taxpayer money. If we wanted to institute a thing where judges could basically put you on probation, where you're mandated to join a club of some kind, and if it costs money, I'm fine as a taxpayer paying that. That's better than the amount of money we'll spend on that 14-year-old when they commit crimes over and over, hurt people, kill people, and then we have to feed and clothe them and take care of them in DOC for 70 years. Like, I'll pay for their basketball club, whatever it is, right?
Those programs are so available and easily accessed.
Yeah, boys and girls clubs are free too. There's a ton of things. Have to go to the boys and girls club after school every day for 4 hours. You have to
sign in, log out.
You have to sign in. That's where you have to be, and then you know that you're at the boys and girls club, and you're not out gang banging on the streets. Like, let's get creative. This is insane. Joanna Kneeler on the DC protests. I cried when I saw the vandalism, maybe because I love America and my husband is retired military. I take patriotism to heart, protesting is one thing, vandalism is not. Again, my dad was a protester in the 70s. My dad was very anti-government, but he also valued this country. Like, when I see someone burning an American flag, I don't think throw them in prison. That's what something like they do and would do in North Korea or China. It tells me a lot about you, but when I see you vandalizing national monuments, assaulting police officers, those are not acts of quote unquote peaceful protest, particularly when it's anti-Semitic graffiti or when it's graffiti celebrating a terror organization. Terrorists descended on Washington, D.C. yesterday. Not insurrectionists, terrorists. And that's not any better, by the way. All right, those have been your questions and comments for today. With that, let's get to our closing sanity check. So we mentioned on the show yesterday that Axios was called out for insisting that Kamala Harris was never named the border czar. That's just what Republicans are calling her, so they can now pin everything that's wrong with the southern border and the border crisis squarely on Kamala Harris's shoulders as she runs for president. And then Axios had to correct itself because it turned out 3 years ago, Axios had also called her the border czar. Because 3 years ago, every major news outlet was calling Kamala Harris the border czar. And this week, they're saying that that is a term manufactured by Republicans.
Vice President Harris was not a border czar.
Meantime, Vice President and border czar Kamala Harris facing some backlash.
What he said about Harris and immigration was not true. She was never appointed border czar.
And this will be her first visit to the U.S.-Mexico border region since she was appointed as the border czar by President Biden.
People gonna have to counter the misinformation. You already hear folks talking about the border czar. She wasn't the border czar.
President Biden tapped Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, to be the border czar.
Now, she wasn't the border czar. That's what Republicans labeled her.
They were very critical of Kamala Harris, especially in her role as border czar.
Now what she's up against is folks lying about her border record, calling her a border czar.
Kamala Harris, who was appointed as the border czar.
The Biden team didn't declare her the border czar. They wanted her to work on kind of the root causes of immigration.
There has been so much criticism against Kamala Harris. You know, she was the border czar.
Calling her sort of the border czar, which wasn't necessarily the case.
So the border, if they weren't planning to address it in a major way, do not make her your border czar. She met with some of the Northern Triangle countries, but nothing has effectively changed.
Interesting how orchestrated all of that sounds. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. Remember, if you've not signed up to support our show already, you can do that at UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com is just $5 a month. Speaking of the border czar, I told you yesterday, the only person I trust to tell me what the truth is about Vice President Kamala Harris's responsibilities at the southern border is our friend Allie Bradley, a dogged border reporter for News Nation. She is going to be our guest on Sundays with subscribers to get to the real truth of the matter. So sign up, UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com, to watch our exclusive weekly interview show. While you're there, shop our merch store, 25% off our Common Sense collection using the promo code Sanity24. So subscribers, I will see you Sunday, bright and early. The rest of you, I will see you back here on the live show Monday at noon.